having just handed in, hopefully, Mini Report 2, it's time to get started on Mini Report 3. That's what today's exercise is all about. So those will be due 2 weeks, 15 minutes ago, 2 weeks from now, beginning a class in 2 weeks, which is the next meeting, by the way, right? Because we don't meet next week. We care today about enzymes, and functionally speaking, what are enzymes? Not proteins. That's not a functional. They are catalysts functionally. Structurally, they are proteins. And catalyst is a more general term. Catalyst is just a substance that speeds a reaction up without actually being a reactant. Now, that's an important difference because if something is a reactant, it's going to get turned into product by the reaction, right? That doesn't happen for a catalyst. The catalyst gets involved with the reactants temporarily, helps them turn into products, but then after that occurs, the catalyst is just like it was to begin with, ready for another round. It's reusable, assuming there's more reactants available. And by the way, if we're talking about a catalyzed reaction, what do we call the reactants? We can call them reactants, but what's another word that describes a reactant of a catalyzed reaction? Right, substrate. So when we're talking about enzymes being the catalyst, which are biological catalysts, substrates bind to the enzymes and get turned into products in the process. Now, originally we thought that all biological catalysts were proteins, and the vast majority are, but since then we've discovered that it's possible for a different kind of macromolecule to act as a catalyst as well. Anyone know what kind? Probably haven't learned it, but in certain cases, RNA molecules can act as a catalyst as well. Now, we reserve the word enzyme to mean specifically a protein catalyst. And so we wouldn't call the kinds of catalysts made out of RNA enzymes, we call them ribozymes, just distinguish them from the proteins. But like I said, almost all biological catalysts are proteins, and they work as catalysts because of their specific shape. If that shape is changed, then they don't do their job as well, because there needs to be a good match between the active site of the enzyme, which is the part on the surface of the enzyme where the substrate binds, and that will allow for product formation to occur much more quickly than if the enzyme weren't involved. A catalyzed reaction doesn't have to have the catalyst for it to occur, but it just won't occur nearly as quickly. A typical catalyst, typical enzyme, will speed up the rate of reaction at least a million times, typically many millions of times faster with an enzyme than without. And so I don't know whether you have talked in lecture about free energy. Have you talked about enzymes even in lecture? Have you talked about free energy? Free energy simply refers to the amount of usable energy that's in a system. Technically, I'm talking about a thermodynamic system, which can be just about anything you want as long as you define it. So a chemical reaction is an example of a system. And a given chemical reaction has a certain amount of free energy locked up in it, which we symbolize as G. G stands for Gibbs free energy, which is its full name, but usually we just say free energy. Anyway, the symbol is G. And if we plot G versus the progress of a chemical reaction, there's a certain value of G associated with the reactant or reactants, the number of substrates. Sometimes it's just one substrate, sometimes multiple substrates, but whatever the reactants are, they have a certain free energy associated with them, and the products are going to have a certain level of free energy associated with them. And in this case, notice that the products have lower G than the reactants.
the overall trace would look like this, but this difference in the initial G and the final G, which would be this height right here, that's delta G. Delta, remember, means difference in. So mathematically, delta G equals G final minus G initial, which would be the same thing as G products, G of the products minus G of the substrates. Notice in this example that I've drawn here, since G final is lower than G initial, that means delta G would be a negative number. A negative value for delta G tells you that that kind of reaction is exergonic. Now, the erg part of that word means energy. X means out. So an exergonic reaction releases energy. Whereas if I had drawn it like this, another example would be like this, with final, the product G being higher than the reactant G, that would be an endergonic reaction. An endergonic reaction requires energy for it to proceed. So exergonic reactions are also spontaneous because they are downhill energetically. Endergonic reactions are non-spontaneous. You have to force them to happen by supplying some energy. But anyway, delta G depends only on what the reaction is, only on what the reactants and the products are. Notice, though, that whether it's exergonic or endergonic, there's this hill that you have to get over in order to transform reactants into products. Even for an overall downhill reaction, like I drew the bigger one, there's still a hill that you have to get over that's even higher than you're starting with before it's going to go to the final products. Well, that additional amount of energy, which would be the height of this bump above this line, that is the energy of activation, or the activation energy, or E sub A. Okay? The reason this all applies to enzymes is that if you catalyze this reaction instead of letting it happen on its own, what the catalyst actually does, and there's different ways this can happen, but what it does in all cases is to lower the value of E sub A. It lowers the activation energy. So in this picture, that would mean you would have a lower hump to get over. And it would be so low that maybe just the thermal energy, just the energy of stuff banging around, will be enough to get you over that hump, which is why it would occur a lot quicker than it would without the enzyme. Okay, but notice, importantly, that the enzyme is changing E sub A. An enzyme never changes delta G, because that only depends on what the products and the reactants are. On this other uphill reaction, this endergonic one, changing the E sub A would make it look like that. Still have a lower hump to get over. Okay, so it's endergonic. You still have to supply energy, but you don't have to supply as much as you would have to without the enzyme's help. Delta G is never affected by enzymes. Activation energy always is. Okay. So, in a sense, this mini report will be maybe a little bit easier to at least follow the general instructions for writing, because this one is truly an experiment. You're manipulating variables. You're collecting data. Okay, that wasn't really the case for the last one you just handed in. It wasn't really an experiment, so it might have been a little harder to follow the instructions. This one, though, is a true experiment. Notice that we're not doing 11.2. So don't waste any time on preparing for that. Cross it out. We're doing 11.1 and 11.3, and they're really separate experiments, but once again, it's one grand experiment that you're writing about that includes two experiments in it. What's the independent variable in 11.1? What is the independent variable in general? What's the definition of it? The thing that you manipulate, right. So what is that in 11.1? From your knowledge of having read ahead of time. Yeah, temperature. You're adjusting temperature. So you're in 11.1, you are assessing the effect of temperature on enzyme activity. how well the enzyme works, in other words. What about 11.3? No, that's the one we skip. That's 11.2 is pH. pH does affect enzyme activity as well, but we're not doing that part. 11.3 is about inhibition. There's different kinds of inhibition of enzymes that you'll cover later in lecture probably, but the easiest one to understand, the one that we're focusing on today, is called competitive inhibition. A given enzyme is specific, meaning that you don't just have one kind of enzyme that you can use for any of your thousands of different kinds of chemical reactions occurring in just a single cell. Just about every individual chemical reaction in metabolism has its own enzyme that's specific for that particular reaction. And so that's because of the specific fit between active site on an enzyme and the particular substrate it acts on, right? Well, there can be some other particle that's not actually the substrate, but that is similar enough to the substrate that it will fit nicely in that active site as well. And that's why this is called competitive inhibition. You have a substrate and some other particle called the inhibitor that are competing for that one available active site on an enzyme molecule. But we don't call the inhibitor a substrate, even though it binds to the active site, because when it does bind to the active site, it doesn't get turned into a product. All it's really doing is blocking the active site of that enzyme so that a substrate can't fit in there. So for that moment, that enzyme might as well not even be there. It's not able to act as an enzyme, right? And so in 11.3, you're going to test the effect of an inhibitor on enzyme activity. Okay? Yeah, because you'll have different amounts of an inhibitor present in your different tubes. Okay, now, listen very carefully to a couple changes we're going to make to this protocol, because the fewer mistakes you make, the more likely it is to get all the way through the procedure, and you want to do that because it's a lot easier to write something up that goes smoothly than if you have problems. In 11.1, it says to use a rating system, I think 1 to 5 or something, or 0 to 5 or whatever, for the color change. You're not doing that at all. Instead, you're doing what it says at the end of the procedure, which is optional use of the spectrophotometer. I'm in 11.1 now. That's how you're going to rate your activity. This machine sitting out is a spectrophotometer. And you probably haven't used them before. They're pretty simple devices, though. A spectrophotometer allows you to indirectly measure the concentration of some solute in a solution. It's an indirect measurement because what the spectrophotometer actually directly measures is the absorbance of light by those solute particles. Okay? If we were to pop the hood on this thing and look what's in the guts of it, you have a lamp that's just emitting white light. White is the combination of all colors. Different colors of light are different colors to us because they have different wavelengths. Okay, so you can have a long wavelength like that or short wavelengths like that. That makes it look different colors to us. But white light is a mixture of all kinds of different wavelengths. Okay? When you set a spectrophotometer to a certain wavelength, which you have to do in order for it to work for the particular kind of stuff you're looking for, the solutes, so make sure your wavelength is correctly set before you start using this thing. What you're really doing, though, is twisting a prism in the light path. And what happens to white light when it hits a prism? It doesn't reflect, it refracts. It spreads the different wavelengths out at different degrees, so each wavelength is going in its own path now. When you set it to a certain wavelength, you're twisting this prism so that just the right wavelength of light goes forward. The rest of it just gets scattered to the side so it doesn't get used. At the far end of this is a little well where you put your tubes in, containing your sample. So if you set it, the wavelength, to a particular value, just that wavelength of light is going to go through your sample. Okay? And it happens to, you set it to be the right wavelength for the type of particle that you're trying to have absorb your light in order to figure out how much is there. At the far end, you have a collector screen that gives you a different voltage depending on how many photons strike it. Photons are little packets of light. So if a photon does not get absorbed, it goes all the way through and the instrument detects it. Okay? But there's three things that can happen when a photon encounters a particle. It can just be transmitted through it, like the particle's not even there. It can be bounced off in some direction. It can be reflected, in other words. Or it can be absorbed. And if it gets absorbed, then it's not going to make it all the way through to the screen. Okay? You can use this spectrophotometer in different modes. You can measure what's called the transmittance by measuring how much light actually gets through. You don't want to be in that mode today, though. So make sure you have your screen so that it has A at the right, using the ATC button. Hopefully it's already set for you, but if it says T, that's transmittance. Don't use the machine in that mode. Make sure it says A for absorbance. Okay, well, when you use a spectrophotometer, the measurements you get are meaningless absolutely. They don't have absolute meaning. They don't stand on their own, in other words. The measurements are only comparative, which means they're based on some other measurement. That some other measurement is a measurement that you set to calibrate the instrument before you measure your unknown solutions. You calibrate the instrument with a tube containing special contents, and we call that the blank. The blank is just like the stuff that you're measuring that you don't know the concentration of, except it doesn't have any of the solute particles. Okay, so the rest of the mixture is the same, but you just don't have any of the solute particles of interest in it. That makes it a blank. In procedure 11.1, it tells you to use, I think, tube 3 as the blank. So make sure you use tube 3 as a blank. On 11.3, it doesn't tell you which one to use. You're using just pure water as the blank in 11.3, sorry. So make sure you do that. Use different blanks for the two different procedures. But what happens is you put a blank in, and the light goes through the blank. Now, some of that light is just going to be scattered by the glass, if nothing else. All right, so not 100% of the light is going to get through. But by hitting that zero button, you're telling the machine, pretend that this is all the light coming through and none is being absorbed. You're defining that as zero amount because you know that blank doesn't have any of those solute particles in it. Then, after you've zeroed it, you switch out to another tube that has some solute in it. Those solute particles are going to absorb additional photons, right? That means the absorbance is going to go up from that zero point. And how high it is determines how many of those particles are present. Now, you could use a spectrophotometer to convert those absorbance values into concentration if you were to make what's called a standard curve. We're not doing that today. You're just working on absorbance values by themselves. But that's still a numerical value rather than you just putting it up to your eye and guessing. Okay? So the higher the absorbance value, since the solutes today are the products that are being formed in these reactions, they're what doing the absorbing. Therefore, the higher the absorbance, the more product has been formed. And therefore, under those conditions, the better the enzyme has worked, because the enzyme's job is to make product out of substrate. So that's what your measurements mean. The higher they are, the better the enzyme works for that situation. Okay? Any questions on any of that? Go ahead.
Is there any wavelength that you have to use?
Yeah, it tells you to set it to 470, I think. These are the things you need to make sure of on the
spectrophotometer. Make sure it's in absorbance mode and not T or C mode. Make sure it's set to 470 nanometers before you do any blanking, any zeroing. Okay? And then also remember that you're using a different blank for the two procedures, tube 3 and 11-1, and then when you go on to 11-3, you're going to re-zero it with pure water. In each of the two experiments, you're zeroing it only once, and then you're making all your other measurements based off of that zero. So notice that the tube that you use to blank it, you also take measurements of that at different times later on, but you don't keep re-zeroing it. You zero it just at time zero, and then you get other measurements, even for that blank tube, later on. Now, you wouldn't expect the blank to have very high absorbance even after a long time, but don't keep re-zeroing it. You zero it one time for each of the two experiments. Okay? Now, I have to make fresh potato extract for you, but you can get your tubes. They should have left you tubes. If they didn't, then go ahead and get fresh tubes. When you're done with your tubes, by the way, clean them up and put them back, leave them at your station. We'll let the next section use them. Anyway, label your tubes 1 through 7 or however many there are. You can write directly on the glass. You don't have to use tape. If you do use tape, though, make sure you take the tape off as part of cleaning them up. Leave them at your station, though. I'll get your potato extract ready and give it to you in little tubes. Well, I'll leave the tubes on ice so that they're still cold. When you're ready for them, come up and get them one tube per group. The turnip extract is what you need for 11-3, and that's more stable, so it's made ahead of time. It's already in the refrigerator. So just when you're ready for keep it in there until you're ready for that, and just get a screw cap tube out of that for turnip extract. You're not doing any of the visual ratings. All you're getting are spectrophotometer readings. And also, don't be confused by the fact that we don't have any baths set up. Instead of the hot baths, we're using these heat blocks over here. One of them is at 40, which is one of the two temperatures. The book says 80 degrees for the other one. It's actually 100 for this one, using this instead of 80. So don't write your report saying you did it at 80 because you did it at 100. Keep good notes as you do this. It'll make writing it easier. The 22-degree one is just room temperature, so you're just keeping it out at your desk for the 22 degrees. And for the 4 degrees, you're going to be using any of these three ice buckets up here. I just have three made up here just so you can spread out, but make sure you not only have your tubes numbered, but make sure you know where you put your individual tubes, or put some mark for your group so you get back your particular tubes. Okay? Any questions? Then follow instructions well, and we can get through this.